Welcome to the Jason Podcast. I'm Josie Briggs, Editor-in-Chief of Jason. My guest today is Dr. Kate Butler. Dr. Butler is a health services researcher and assistant professor in the Division of Nephrology at the University of Washington. She also holds a master's degree from the University of Washington Department of Bioethics. Her research is related to issues related to the intensity of care of older adults with kidney failure at the end of life, as well as the tough ethical considerations that arise in allocating scarce healthcare resources, such as transplants, or contending with resource shortages during the pandemic. She has been an active and very valuable part of our editorial team as an editorial fellow for the last almost 2 years. So, Dr. Butler, thanks for joining me for this conversation. I know you've given a lot of thought to the challenges, ethical and practical, in engaging patients with advanced kidney disease in decisions about their care. I've really enjoyed your insights into these issues, and so I'm delighted we can bring you into this discussion for Jason podcast listeners.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Jesse.
The focus of our discussion today is a perspective in the May issue. The authors are Dr. Fahad Saeed, Alvin Moss, Paul Duberstein, and Kevin Fiskella. It has a thought-provoking title, Enabling Patient Choice, The Deciding Not to Decide Option for Older Adults Facing Dialysis Decisions.
And I agree. This is a really timely piece in the context of what we know to be a growing body of work questioning the value of our traditional approach to advanced care planning. And the authors here propose a way to rethink our current model.
Before we get into this perspective essay, let's give our listeners a little background. In some ways, it builds on the findings in a study we published about a year ago, June 21, by Karen Ladden and co-authors. The senior author was Daniel Weiner. That was a study of advanced care planning in older adults with CKD. Can I ask you to remind our readers about that study? What did they do and what did they learn?
Yes, so this study was entitled Advanced Care Planning in Older Adults with CKD, and it was a qualitative work based on semi-structured interviews with older adults with CKD and also their care providers or their care partners and their clinicians about experiences with advanced care planning, and that included barriers and facilitators. So one of the primary findings was that there were really striking differences in the understanding of what ACP really even means. For clinicians, advanced care planning was largely about completion of documentation, so preferences for intensive interventions like CPR and mechanical ventilation in the context of future serious illnesses. But for patients and their care partners, they really wanted a more holistic discussion about goals, prognosis, and disease trajectory. So that kind of broader definition of what ACP involves might be better supported by starting discussions earlier and by integrating planning, not just about end-of-life care, but also about treatment decision-making throughout the course of illness. And that could take the form of more of an evolving discussion rather than a decision point once in time.
Right. One of the really surprising themes in the Ladden study was that many of the subjects had really serious questions about the value of advanced care planning. And that was from both patients and clinicians. That surprised me. We often take it as a given that ACP is a value. What are some of the reasons that emerged for questioning the value of advanced care planning?
Right. I agree. That's a key finding. And it probably relates to this disconnect in thinking about what the goal of ACP is in the first place. So they found that first, clinicians question the value of ACP, as you say. So one clinician put it pretty simply, to quote, deteriorating health makes people change their decisions. So, of course, that kind of changing preference in combination with what clinicians described as prognostic uncertainty and uncertainty about how to counsel patients about what the future might entail meant that documentation now might not really be helpful in informing future decisions from their perspective. And then patients also question the value of ACP. Patients might think that it wasn't quite right time, wasn't quite the right time for ECP, or that this kind of planning might not be urgent, especially when their kidney function was relatively stable. And they might just not be ready to talk about it, or to not ready to make plans for the future. So the themes that resulted from this paper, in addition to this growing body of work from others, really speaks to the need to adapt our approach to ACP. So far, advanced care planning has been mostly about decisions about specific interventions, specific intensive interventions at the end of life. And it totally makes sense that clinicians want to understand preferences about these kinds of interventions in advance, because how one spends the end of life is important and it's personal. And patients are typically not able to make these kinds of decisions in the moment if they're very seriously ill. But while that might be well-intentioned, and we understand that goal, it also just might not make sense to patients to decide on specific treatments in advance. Their preferences may be totally dependent on the context, the future context, when the need is actually arising, and what kind of life opportunities are available to them at that time, how their family feels, other things like this. And then for some, planning for the future might just feel less important than living in the present. So I don't think that any of these observations mean that we need to totally throw out the idea of advanced care planning, but it does suggest that we need to be maybe a bit more flexible in how we present options, and then plan for kind of repeated discussions over time.
So let's turn to the option Dr. Saeed and co-authors put forward, deciding not to decide. How might that help address some of these uncertainties?
Yes, so I think there are parallels in the challenges we're seeing for advanced care planning for intensive interventions at the end of life, and also advanced decisions about treatments for kidney failure. And one issue, if you think big picture, is that the needs of healthcare processes as they're currently designed might not always align with what patients are needing or thinking. So, for example, what might be best from the healthcare system's perspective is that we make early decisions for or against dialysis, and that helps us to get patients set up in one of multiple care pathways. So, dialysis and or transplant or no dialysis, and then we can have time to make advanced preparations like fistula placement. And that totally may work for some patients. There may be a clear decision for some, especially for young people who are otherwise pretty healthy. But many people may not see their choices as all or nothing, as one or the other. They may shift between treatment options. They may value both longevity and comfort-focused care. Their sense of when's the right time to think about making these decisions that will inevitably impact their personal and their social lives is also, of course, not just dependent on medical considerations, but other life events and social context. So patients might not be ready to decide on our timeline. I've also met patients who are intellectually totally understand their kidney disease. They're tracking their numbers. They're really engaged, but they can still find it really difficult to grasp the need to make this kind of life-changing transition, starting dialysis, without feeling the symptoms of kidney failure. So for me, for all these reasons, deciding not to decide is a middle way. It's recognizing that decisions about kidney failure treatment require ongoing conversation, and they have to be integrated with larger life goals.
The authors in this paper provide a nice table with a list of the positives and negatives of this approach. What are some other key arguments for the value of the approach?
So for patients, a decision not to decide, or you could call it a wait-and-see approach, give them time to make decisions that fit with their life and illness as they experience it. So for older adults, for those with other comorbid conditions, many may have other complications. They may even die before initiating dialysis. So a decision not to decide may avoid extra procedures that we've been talking about, like fistula placement. And it also avoids the energy expenditure and maybe even anxiety associated with planning for dialysis when it may not ultimately be needed in their lifetimes.
Right. What are some of the downsides of the deciding not to decide approach?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is important, and I like that the authors included this pretty explicitly. So for patients electing this deciding not to decide option, it might mean more people starting dialysis emergently, starting with catheters rather than fistulas. But again, just to reinforce, I think it's also important to recognize that there's also downsides to expending time and energy to learn about dialysis, to have a fistula placement surgery, and then maybe change one's mind or even die, you know, before starting dialysis. The authors also list that there's a possibility that patients, of course, might not be able to participate as much in decision making if it's kind of pushed down the line because they can become uremic as their disease progresses. And, you know, just in reading this article and thinking about it, I'd add another slightly different concern, and it's alluded to by the authors, but throughout the piece. And that's that our healthcare system is built around these siloed care pathways. So advocates for conservative kidney care are really finding that one of the major barriers to providing that kind of care is the lack of a dedicated care pathway for conservative care. So, you know, they report that clinicians may not feel expert in treating patients who elect not to receive dialysis. They don't know who's responsible for these patients. There's not a way to get them the kind of built-in rich resources that are available to people starting dialysis, like social workers and dietitians and therapists. So reflecting on this potential group of people who choose not to decide, they're also not easily slotted into a care pathway. So they might encounter some of these same kinds of challenges. And of course, this is a broader problem with adapting to a person-centered rather than disease-focused approach to care throughout our health system.
Right. You and I have discussed in other contexts the need for a pathway for conservative care. This is an important problem. Just one other comment. The essay starts with a short anecdote about a patient who had lived for 2 years with a buzzing AV fistula that was not yet needed, but the fistula served as a constant and depressing reminder of the future need for dialysis and clearly worsened his quality of life. That story moved me because many years ago when I was at the NIH, we supported research on the problems caused by late access placement, research that was part of the arguments for recently set up incentives for earlier access placement. Clearly, that work the need for early access placement had unanticipated adverse consequences. Something all policy measures are vulnerable to. Any comment?
I love that this struck you. It's such an important observation. It really prompts this question about the role and value and limitations of health policy. So policy works on a population level. It works on population level patterns, but not all individuals will fit into a mold, and there ultimately needs to be space to tailor care to individual needs. So you could maybe say that the optimal policy could act as a sort of guardrail to ensure a reasonable baseline of care and to reduce barriers to care options. But we need to make sure that it also doesn't disincentivize the opportunity for individual patients to choose among a breadth of reasonable treatment options. And of course, this is important to think about as we're moving forward with campaigns and regulations to increase rates of home dialysis modalities under the Advancing American Kidney Health Initiative and others, other projects. So new policies should be designed to address system level barriers to patients receiving home modalities. But then we have to keep in mind that we also shouldn't be striving for all patients to be on PD or to receive a transplant, but instead we should make sure that options are all available and as flexible as possible for patients.
Very well put. So as we wrap up, I'd like to digress briefly and talk about qualitative research. Jason has historically not published many qualitative studies, but we're rethinking that, and we're learning how to look at this kind of work with greater respect. We're learning these methods have evolved standards that bring a level of rigor to inherently subjective questions, and we're facing tough questions that can only be approached with these methods. You, together with your colleagues, contributed an excellent perspective on qualitative research to Jason last year. Please give us, our listeners, a short introduction of what the key elements are that we should think about as we look at qualitative studies.
Sure. And I, of course, totally agree with your comment on the value of qualitative work. The kinds of questions that we ask as kidney clinicians and researchers these days are just increasingly and incredibly varied and complex. And qualitative analysis is just another tool in the research kit. It's especially helpful in describing complex care processes and experiences of patients, clinicians, their care partners. So for hypothesis-based work, we have to know something about the phenomenon that we're studying first, because we have to make predictions and then test them. Qualitative work also offers the chance to describe things about which we didn't know we didn't know. We didn't know how to make hypotheses or predictions about them. And I think these kinds of approaches can be valuable in nephrology for a few reasons. So the situation described or studied by Layden and colleagues that we talked about earlier is a great example. It's clear that we've had trouble as a community establishing treatment plans in advance for people with kidney disease. So we could do to take a step back and ask about how and whether and when patients need help in planning for future treatments. How is this planning shaped by experiences with their medical providers? With how is it shaped by their psychosocial context, their family relationships? And answers to those kinds of questions can then inform studies to quantify the frequency of certain barriers and facilitators to ACP, for example. It can inform the design of interventions to support ACP. So that just as an example. And then I think qualitative work is also going to be key for understanding the impact of racism in access to care and care processes in nephrology. This situation is, as we know increasingly, it's very complex. And if we're going to move beyond quantifying the impact of systemic racism to finding ways to improve, we need to start identifying more specific and intervenable causes and effects of structural and interpersonal and internalized racism. It's also clear that implicit biases of everyone, including researchers, shape our understanding and how we might design research projects. And that's no different for qualitative researchers and qualitative work. But this kind of approach specifically is designed to recognize and consider researchers' biases in the work and develop an understanding of these processes that's grounded more in patient experience. So that's the value there, the potential value.
Thank you. That's very well put. I think that qualitative researchers have learned a kind of humility of knowing that we don't know what we need to know. That's really valuable. And it is, of course, centered on listening, particularly listening to patients. So, Kate, I really thank you for your sharing your thoughts about advanced care planning and this interesting perspective, deciding not to decide. We've enjoyed and really benefited from your participation in our editorial fellowship program. Can I ask you to share with our listeners any thoughts about being a Jason editorial fellow? What have you learned? Were there any surprises?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So the Jason editorial fellowship has honestly been one of the more valuable experiences of my research training and early academic career. So I really do thank you and the editorial board for the opportunity. It's been helpful for me to learn how to situate individual research projects, both that are related to my own work and also completely different from my own experience, in the greater context of existing science. It's reminded me of how important it is not just to put raw results out there into the world, but and especially as we develop questions and methods that are more complex, it's important to help contextualize research findings for others. And the editorial board does that by guiding authors and explaining methods, framing discussions, things like that, as well as inviting perspective pieces. And then, of course, now doing podcasts like this. I'll add one more thing. As an early investigator, it's been helpful to witness how the editorial board is really rooting for researchers like me to do well. And I appreciate the energy and enthusiasm that the editorial board and reviewers have put in. So again, I appreciate the chance to just thank you and the board for the opportunity to participate in the fellowship and for the chance to talk today.
Well, thank you, Kate. The editorial fellowship has been for all of the editors truly an enriching experience. I think we thought when we started it was out of a duty to the next generation, but we're actually learning more from them than I think we are teaching you. But it also adds to the fun and excitement of the process. So thank you to our listeners. This will wrap up this month's podcast.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare provider if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.